Hello and welcome aboard this podcast of RTÉ Radio 1's maritime programme Seascapes, which is presented and produced by Marcus Connaughton. You can email the programme seascapes@rte.ie. Hello and welcome aboard this week's edition of your maritime programme Seascapes. Have you ever wondered about how we respect our seas? Spare a thought for the Great Barrier Reef, where there are plans to dump tons of sediment. More later. This weekend, events are being held by the local community and the RNLI to mark the centenary of the loss of the Mexico and the lifeboat from Feathered, the Helen Blake. We hear about a lecture next week in the National Maritime Museum of Ireland by meteorologist Evelyn Cusack. First this week, to a wilderness where Shackleton, Keohane, Tom Crean and the McCarthy brothers explored, and which one of our great mariners, Edward Bransfield, discovered. Naturalist, tour guide and writer Jim Wilson has just returned after several months aboard Sea Spirit in Antarctica. He talked to Seascapes about the experience.
I always tell people it's the closest you'll get to leaving the planet without getting off, because it's all so unfamiliar if you've never been there before. It is unbelievable. And the imprint of humanity down there is so relatively small. It's incredible. You can almost set your watch by the depressions that come racing through that gap between Tierra del Fuego, right down at the very end of South America, and that finger of Antarctica that sticks up, which is the peninsula, which is where most of the cruise ships go. And they literally squeeze through that narrow channel, and the wind speeds are just phenomenal, and the swells can be just incredible. And of course, that's why they've been made famous in literature, and you know, the stories that sailors have told, and the number of ships that have sank down there, phenomenal during the age of sail. So yeah, you have to watch your forecast. Thankfully, we've got satellites and everything now, so it really helps us a lot. But you knowing that you've got to go across the Drake Passage, getting down to the peninsula and then back to get people back to their connections for their flights back home, and that by the time they're getting towards the end of their trip, they're acutely aware of the forecast, and then it's praying that they're going to get that gap between the depressions so that they won't get bumped all over the place as they cross the channel. The ship we're on is the Sea Spirit, and it's just shy of 300 feet long, and the crew, including officers, is just under 90, it was. And that was for a maximum complement of passengers of 114. So it's not like most of the cruise liners we've been seeing down in Cove and in Cork Harbour. This is a very small ship by comparison. And then you have to have a captain and officers who are experienced in sailing in ice. And not only that, but not all of Antarctica, even around the peninsula, has been charted properly. So there are times when actually we have to be ultra careful what we're doing.
And of course, pack ice can come out of nowhere. It's all very well seeing icebergs, which are a different matter altogether. But pack ice can very suddenly make itself known.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've got two things. You've got the great big icebergs, and some of these bergs that we, for example, we would see in an average season, some of them are, you know, nearly 200 feet above sea. So you're talking about another 600-700 feet below sea level. Huge pieces of ice. And when they're that big, the wind actually doesn't have much of an effect on them. It's the currents that move them about usually. But the pack ice that you mentioned, a lot of that is ice that was sea ice during the winter. It's after breaking up. It's in slabs now. Some of them, you know, they might be no bigger than an average living room, and others may be the size of a football pitch. They're all bits and pieces, and they can be blown around incredibly quickly. And you could end up with a band of pack ice a couple of miles wide, moving behind you, if you're in a bay. And unless the wind changes, you could be stuck there for days because, as I mentioned, our ship is not an icebreaker. It's ice strengthened. But to get out of there would be a very tricky manoeuvre indeed and something probably a captain would prefer to avoid. So he's watching our back all the time. And if there's any sign of a change of weather that may result in us being caught in any way, we would abandon whatever landing we were doing, back to the ship, and we'd move straight away.
So what's a typical day like for you, Jim, on board a vessel like that? Obviously, you're talking about some of our great explorers from this country, and I'm sure reminding some of the audience, they're drawn from all over, as to the nationality of some of those explorers that they might not necessarily be aware of.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, when you go down there, quite a few of the historians tend to be of the classical style, whereby all you hear is Shackleton and Scott. And in fact, you don't hear Amundsen even that often, who was you know, one of the most amazing polar explorers. And as an Irishman who's proud of his Irish heritage and wanting to fly the flag, I often have to remind them about the contribution that other nationalities made. And it's often pointed out like that it was Shackleton, Worsley and Crean that, you know, crossed over South George and walked into that whaling station, Stromness whaling station manager's house, and eventually led to the rescue of the other 22 on Elephant Island. And I'll always remember my boss, our expedition leader, as she's known as, is from New Zealand. And of course, Worsley was New Zealand, but they rarely mentioned that. And she, like me, would point out that it was a New Zealander and two Irishmen that actually rescued the group, not English, as is often the case. So you know, I think looking at Ireland now and the success of Michael Smith's books on Tom Crean, for example, I mean, we've got the most educated young adults in the country when it comes to the Antarctic and exploration, because they are all doing the story of Tom Crean as part of the curriculum. And when I tell this to the people on the ships, they're blown away by this, absolutely blown away by it. But you'd be amazed the number of people who only have the old, as I say, traditional classical view of these explorers. I mean, Cork alone had a whole gang of them. I mean, you had Patrick Keohane, you had Robert Ford, you had the McCarthy brothers from down in Kinsale. You know, those alone, and a lot of them signed up here in the harbour down in Cove, then Queenstown, and they were part of these expeditions. And you often think that it was just Shackleton on his own, or Scott on his own, or all these people on their own, whereas in fact they had teams of highly experienced seamen with them.
Isn't it also about the relationship that these guys have had? You look at Ford and the fact that he built that hut. You know, you think about stuff like that, stuff that has lasted right through over a century ago.
Yeah.
And also, I suppose, it brings home to one the fact of, you mentioned it earlier, Bransfield, of course, from Middleton.
Yeah, I mean, Bransfield is amazing. And I hope in the not too distant future, and definitely for it's the bicentenary of the discovery of the Antarctic continent by Bransfield. In fact, there's recent information after coming to light. The story goes that Bransfield was down there in 1820, and there was another explorer, a Russian, Bellinghausen, and he was down there too. And it is said that Bellinghausen saw the continent 3 days before Bransfield did. And Bransfield, Edward Bransfield was his name, he was press-ganged into the Royal Navy from Ballinacurra here in Cork Harbour. But one of the successes of the British Navy is that they didn't care where you've come from. If you're good, you rose through the ranks. And he rose all the way up through the ranks from his humble beginnings down in Ballinacurra. And he ended up being the navigator of the ship that went down to do a lot of the initial charting of the Antarctic Peninsula, where we go with our cruise liners today. But the recent information is that the Russians were operating on a different calendar. And apparently it looks quite likely now that Bransfield was without doubt the first human being to see the Antarctic continent that we know of. And he's from here in Cork.
Obviously, as a naturalist, you were on that trip. You saw some remarkable sights, no doubt. Any firsts for you?
I mean, the one that comes to mind immediately was my first blue whale, one of the rarest whales on the planet, and also the biggest creature ever to exist on the planet. And near South George, there's a group of very jagged rocks called the Shag Rocks, not to be confused with the Stag Rocks from West Cork, the Shag Rocks, because these birds, they're like cormorants called shags, nest on it. So that's a good reason to call them the Shag Rocks. And we had a following sea sort of around 10 metres swell. In fact, deck 4 was being washed from behind now and again. So we had faith in our captain. We were doing fine. We were clipping along nicely. Thankfully, we weren't going head on into it. And out of nowhere, like a nuclear-powered submarine, this amazing creature surfaced. Of course, I was out on deck. That's part of my job. There were people out on deck, and I was showing them albatrosses and fur seals and all sorts of things that were out there at the time, even in that rough weather. And here comes this magnificent blue whale. In fact, the what we call cetaceans, which are the whales and dolphins, the action we had with them on this season was incredible. We had an encounter with between 100 and 150 fin whales feeding together. It gave us an idea of what it must have been like when the whalers went down there first, and there were so many whales, pilot whales.
Very encouraging, though, to see so many fin whales, and also the fact that we get some of them off our coast here, coming into places like Wexford off Hook Head, and then further down in West Cork. Yeah. And these things are the size of two double-decker buses, so they're not small.
No,
creatures.
No, they're enormous. I mean, the fin whale, you know, it's around the 70 foot mark, just a little bit less, depending on the size of it. And so that's the second biggest creature ever to live on the planet, by the way. And yes, we do have them here off the coast, South Coast in particular. And to see that many, obviously, the hunting has stopped pretty much, apart from the scientific whaling carried out still by the Japanese, but still nothing like the scale it was carried out in those days. And in fact, when we go to South Georgia and even onto the peninsula, we still see the remains of the whaling factories, especially on South Georgia, the land-based ones. They're still just rusting away now as silent monuments to an incredible industry. And the Norwegians who went down there, primarily they were Norwegian, to set up the whaling stations. Carl Anton Larsen was the first guy really to set up major whaling down there. You can still see the remains of it was like small towns they had. What limited their catching ability was not finding whales. It was the fact that they couldn't process them quick enough. And in the space of 100 years, they wiped most of them out. But incredible to be able to go down and see it. And one legacy of them has now just about disappeared. They brought down reindeer. Just, I think, in around between 1906 and 1914. And they liked the place, the reindeer, and a couple of herds of them were set up. There was a few thousand at their peak, but they were destroying the habitat of South Georgia. So they've actually removed them all. And I think the last herd was taken off this season. So at the end of an era from that point of view.
Now, access, obviously, off this vessel, the Sea Spirit, is by a rib or zodiac, as you might say. And that gives you, I suppose, and those who are on the cruise, wonderful access to areas where a large vessel can't really get in.
Yeah, absolutely, Marcus. The thing is, you've got a stack. We've about 10 or 12 of these zodiacs. They're just large black rubber dinghies. They can accommodate. We usually put no more than 10 guests in it per trip, and then there'd be a driver as well. And what we do is we lower them. They're stacked on the back deck, just off the back deck, and they're lowered over by crane. And then we've got what's called a marina deck down below, where you're almost like it looks like a jetty almost. You're only a couple of feet above the sea, and then they're loaded carefully into the zodiacs, the guests, and they're usually 60 horsepower outboard engines, and that allows us then to go places where any ship that's anyway larger could not go at all. So the experience that you get is absolutely phenomenal.
So what about weather conditions? Obviously, you're not going to be launching Zodiacs in big seas.
When you sign up for one of these trips, you actually do sign a document to say that you understand that A, you're going somewhere where there may not be help, so don't expect it, and also that the weather will dictate everything. And for example, on one trip, we had to hide from the mother of all storms. It was the winds, I think, were hitting 180 to 200 kilometres an hour. And we hid behind an island, Isla de los Estados, Staten Island, I believe it's same as the one in New York, same name, just off Tierra del Fuego. We hid behind that island for a day and we clocked 86 kilometres an hour wind. And I think it was 86 knots. And that was in the shelter. And we lost a day. But what we did then is we eventually got across to South Georgia and we did three landings a day instead of two, which meant that our guests got their complement of landings, and we were totally flattened by the time we finished our trip in South Georgia. And then we have 2 days at sea before we head to Elephant Island, so we were able to rest up. So yeah, the weather dictates everything. You get up in the morning, you look out, and we might have decided to go to A, B and C, and it might be D, E and F the minute you see it. And again, we do all the drill. If we're ashore and the weather can change. I've seen the weather go from, 5 or 10 knots of wind up to 80 or 90 knots of wind in the space of 15 minutes. So you have to be able to move fast, and safety is uppermost. One of my main jobs on the ship is interpretation of the wildlife, and in particular the birds. And I spend a lot of my time trying to get the guests to realise that, we're land-centred creatures, whether we like it or not. Even if we spend a lot of time at sea, take the ship and all the props away and we're goosed. But these are sea-centred creatures. The penguins, for example, spend at least 80% of their lives in water. I mean, they're closer to being a fish than they are to being a bird, to be honest. But when you see the conditions, the seas that they're out in, you do sort of tend to put the kind of human stamp on them and kind of go, oh my God, how do they survive it? But they're made to survive it. They're incredibly robust. I've seen them, on rough seas getting out of from the surf onto the rocks, and they're like skittles. They're being bounced all over the place. They might fall 30, 40 feet and bounce a couple of times, and they'll get to the bottom and they'll kind of stand up and they'll shake themselves down and off again they go. I mean, they really are, and they're made for it. So when you see these creatures, and once you bear that in mind and you look at them, it kind of, you really, the wow factor goes through the roof, because you realise that, what a design, and it's all inbuilt. They don't need anything else bar what they're standing in.
Finally, Jim, what about big surprises? Because this is somewhere, Antarctica is a place you've been before. This particular trip obviously was a lengthy one. Mm. Anything that stands out for you?
The thing about going down there is it's always different. It'll never be boring, because it's such an amazing place. And the sort of standout things, I think definitely the whales and dolphins that we came across were just incredible, absolutely incredible. I also think that, when you see the way the place is still so pristine, no jet trails, is always fantastic. For those of the listeners who are interested in a bit of astronomy, as a lot of the seafaring folk are in Ireland, to see Orion, that big constellation with the belt, but to see it upside down is quite amazing. The fact that the belt with the sword, well, the sword doesn't point down, it points up. Stuff like that, it was incredible. But and to think that some of the glaciers, even since I've been going down, which is in 2007, I'm even noticing, looking back on my photographs, that the retreat of some of them, the speed at which these glaciers are retreating is quite phenomenal. And then to get rain also, I mean, the Antarctic is considered the driest continent on the planet, and starting to get rain there, I mean, that's having a huge effect on particularly the penguins, because they're not designed for getting wet. At all, the young ones, that is. They're all real downy and fluffy, but and then sometimes they're getting too much snow because of the way the climate is changing, and all a result of the warming up, but it's leading to a lot of trouble down there. But overall, some creatures doing well. The king penguins, you know, increasing in numbers is always fantastic to see. But you never know what's around the corner when you're there. And it's such a privilege to be able to go there and show people, you know, this last really pristine wilderness that we have on the planet.
Naturalist, writer, broadcaster and tour guide Jim Wilson on his recent exploits in Antarctica. Jim's latest book with photographer Mark Carmody is The Birds of Ireland, A Field Guide, and is published by the Collins Press.
We'll sail across the ocean, a stormy Minch this day. The wind will fill our eager sails to lovely Stornoway. We've been to lonely Barra and trawled round Mingalay. So now we'll tack and sail right back to lovely Stornoway.
Songwriter and poet Cliff Wedgbury and his own composition, Lovely Stornoway, taken from his brand new CD, Bide a While. Congratulations go to our own Brian Carlin, who is en route in the next leg of the Clipper Round the World Yacht Race to Qingdao. His photography features on the Sailing Anarchy website, and they write, Brian Carlin made this piece of wall art on the Brisbane-Singapore leg of the pay-to-play Clipper race. Less than 3 years into the sport, the diminutive Irishman has a long and brilliant career ahead of him. We say well done. You can see more on the Seascapes webpage, www.rte.ie/radio1/Seascapes. Speaking of the Clipper Round the World Yacht Race, we read that Conor O'Byrne off the Derry-Londonderry boat sustained a wrist injury, so misses out on the leg to Qingdao. Wishing you a speedy recovery, Conor, and welcome home. The National Maritime Museum of Ireland in Dún Laoghaire, in association with the Irish Met Society, are having a lecture titled Ireland's Weather, A Journey Through Time. That's taking place in the museum on Hay Terrace. The lecture will be given by the doyen of Irish weather forecasters, Evelyn Cusack. Evelyn is Deputy Head of Forecasting Met Éireann and Secretary of the Irish Met Society. You'll be guaranteed to hear about Admiral Beaufort. Evelyn will give the talk on Thursday next at 7:30 p.m. Admission is €10 and all proceeds in aid of the National Maritime Museum of Ireland. On the 9th of December in 1886, the Mexico, a Hamburg-registered bark bound for Guayaquil from Liverpool, went aground near Southport in a full west-northwesterly gale. Regular listener Bernard McCann in Preston in Lancashire, on hearing about the Mexico centenary in Wexford this weekend, was in touch about this vessel of the same name, which was lost back in 1886 near Lytham St. Anne's. Well, this weekend, distinguished author Owen Colfer and composer Liam Bates will join forces to host a concert on the centenary of the feathered lifeboat disaster of 1914, which saw 9 crewmen of the RNLI vessel, the Helen Blake, lose their lives aiding the shipwrecked Norwegian schooner, the Mexico, off the coast of Wexford. The concert is hosted by Wexford Sinfonia this Saturday in Wexford County Hall to honour and remember the crew members of the Mexico and the RNLI who lost their lives. The performance will include a specially commissioned piece by composer Liam Bates, Heroes of the Helen Blake. There's a ceremony at the Borough on Rosslare Strand on Sunday afternoon, and Seascapes will be there. We'll have a full report next Friday. It's really hard to believe, but Australian authorities have given approval for plans to dump 3 million cubic metres of sediment in the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park to coincide with plans to enlarge one of the world's largest coal ports. This development is to facilitate the extra 70 million tonnes of coal that is likely to go through the port at Abbott Point on the Queensland coast. The North Queensland Bulk Ports Corporation are on record saying that, we quote, that flora and fauna are unlikely to be damaged by the dumping and are arguing that disposal of the spoil on land would be more environmentally damaging. Greenpeace are saying, not surprisingly, that any dumping of spoil on the reef would be an international embarrassment. We wouldn't throw rubbish on World Heritage sites like the Grand Canyon, so why would we dump on the reef? As you can imagine, most Australians are shocked and angry. What do you think? Seascapes@rte.ie is our email address. Next week here on Seascapes, we'll have a full report from the Burrough in Wexford, marking that centenary of the Helen Blake and the rescue off that coast of those aboard the Norwegian-registered Mexico. A new shanty group formed in the seaside town of Cove. Author and historian Michael Martin of the Titanic Trail is a member, and he'll explain how they came together and give details of their first major appearance. All that and much more here on Seascapes. Until next Friday night, tight lines and fair sailing.